When all is ready, I throw this switch.
Ho, ho, hello, everyone, and welcome to a merry... Welcome to a merry edition of the Collected Edition, a comic book podcast where we discuss the naughty and nice runs and story arcs throughout the history of comics. I'm Paul Matthew Carr, and with me, as always, is Brian Reese.
If I had some advance warning, I would have come up with some witty banter to go along with that, but here we are. Happy, Merry Christmas, Happy Holidays.
Happy Holidays. To let everyone know, this is being recorded a little bit before Christmas, but it's going to serve as our New Year / Christmas episode. Today on the program, we'll be pulling out our cosmic rods to see which one is bigger. We'll be discussing Starman, Sins of the Father by James Robinson and Tony Harris. But as I said, this is going to be our kind of New Year, end of the year episode as well. So Brian and I have put together our favorite comics of the year. Brian, how would you like to do this? We both chosen five comics. Knowing Brian, you've chosen five comics and then 20 others.
No, I mean, of course, what's interesting is we didn't do this last year because of a variety of reasons. So
yes,
I do want to give a shout out to Matt Fraction's Jimmy Olsen comic from a year ago, because that would have been my number one.
I think we mentioned it last year.
We might have done.
Yeah. God, you know what? The last 2 years have just been this blur of weirdness. I can't remember what we've done and what we haven't done.
Yeah. Well, I don't think it's going to get any better.
I don't either.
I'm trying to stay positive here. And, you know, best case scenario, it's not going to get any better.
Well, in this day and age, it's best not to be positive.
Hey, well, this is true.
Yes. Anywho, we both picked out some comics, and I think we're going to have some overlap just from what we've talked about in the past.
And anybody who's
Brian and I are actually friends, so we talk about this stuff even when we're not on this microphone. Yeah. So do you want to go back and forth, or do you want to just list all yours and then I'll list all of mine?
Let's go back and forth. Why not? Do you want to start with honorable mentions? Do you want me to go first, or you?
You go first with your honorable.
So I have five that we'll talk about, and I just have. Okay, so five honorable mentions that could have easily been in the top 10 or top five, sorry, but they didn't, because I had to make choices and so that's hard. So I'm not really going to say anything about these other than these five comics I think are, any one of these could easily have been in the top five.
Okay.
So the bottom five, the honorable mentions are That Texas Blood.
Hmm.
Swamp Thing, Rom V's Swamp Thing with Mike Perkins, Matt Fraction's and Terry and Rachel Dodson's Adventure Man, J.H. Williams' Echolands, which is stunning, and of course, basically anything Jeff Lemire does with Black Hammer, of which there have been a few things. So all those five have all been what I feel like are excellent comics that I've enjoyed immensely this year.
I'm writing down Echoland because I haven't actually read that.
You haven't read it, Paul?
No, I know, but I'm writing it down.
Williams.
I know, I'm writing it down right now. My honorable mention is also Jeff Lemire, but it's Primordial.
Ah, yes.
The only reason it's an honorable mention is because it's just started. I mean, I assume it's going to end perfectly, but for right now. So it's Jeff Lemire and Andrea Sorrentino. Sorry. Yeah, it's just been, man, there are certain writers that just, everything they do is great. And Jeff Lemire is one of them.
Yes.
All right. So before we begin with our top five, I have to say, when we decided to do this, I just wrote down off the top of my head what my five favorite comics were. And then when I looked at them, I realized, well, they're pretty much the same authors. Yeah. It's five comics and three authors. It's just like, oh man.
Oh.
Yeah. but I'm going with it because they were my favorites from this year. And shockingly, not one is Marvel.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, I think that, so just a spoiler alert, this will be a Marvel free.
Which is, you know, it's not that I'm not reading Marvel comics. It's just, I haven't been blown away by any of them. I've been enjoying Marvel comics, but not, you know, there's nothing that stood out.
I think Daredevil has been great, but I listed that a couple of years ago when Chip Zdarsky first started over it. But, you know, now it's fallen into an event. And
That could be said of every single Marvel comic. It's great until an event happens.
They often have kept Daredevil out of big events. And I think it's I don't know editorially how that has worked. I think part of it is just the nature of who's writing Daredevil. They always get, for the most part, they get some real, you know, superstar writer. Everybody wants to write Daredevil. And I mean, there was that god-awful Daredevil event years ago. What was it, Shadowlands or whatever?
Oh my God, that was awful. Yes, I remember that.
Stinker. But anyway,
because you said you had recommended Daredevil when it first began, I of course have recommended Immortal Hulk back when it began, and that just ended this year, but I didn't feel that continued to be great all the way through.
It got poisoned a little bit towards the end, not due to the comic itself, but one of the creators. Which maybe kind of took the sheen off a little bit of the ending of what many folks feel was a kind of seminal.
People dropped off of it or didn't talk about it as much. It still continued to be a good comic, well-written comic, and excellent idea, but it's not really a 2021 comic. It's it started 2 years ago. But anyway, enough of that. Top five. What do you have for number five?
I have Serial by Terry Moore.
Cool.
Yeah, to me, it's I'm a big, you know, it's sometimes I you know, it's funny, we're talking nostalgia today later on. And, you know, for me, comics like little Strangers in Paradise is always going to have. And in comics from that era, that sort of independent underground, it wasn't really underground, but it was self-published. The comics of that time, Minimum Wage was another one. Whatever Dave Laffam was doing, Stray Bullets, things like that. Anytime those writers or artists or whatever, you know, kind of emerge again, I'm always very interested. And I think Terry Moore has been doing some really interesting post Strangers in Paradise stuff. And so, you know, his latest comic, it's going to run 10 issues. I think we're on issue, I just read issue 8, I think. And so, again, it's his really sort of interesting artwork. It's, you know, the black and white, and the subject matter is pretty rough on this one. I don't want to go into too much detail, but I find that anytime Terry Moore puts something out, I have an interest, and I think this is one of his stronger pieces that he's done in recent years. So, Serial by Terry Moore.
Okay. Again, that's one that's on my list to read, but I haven't actually gotten to it yet. But I will. I'm writing stuff down. We should do that. We should do best of lists all the time, because you always come up with ones that I want to read. So,
and vice versa.
Okay. So my number five is Strange Adventures by Tom King and Mitch Gerards. This is, of course, Adam Strange, and it is it continues in the Tom King oeuvre of depression and PTSD that he's become really, really good at. I'm being flippant, but he's excellent at writing about that subject, whether it's, but you know, it's Vision or Mr. Miracle or Heroes in Crisis. He's just excellent at grabbing that inner turmoil and PTSD. He's great at it. So anyway, Strange Adventures, it's about Adam Strange, and it's about his strange adventures, but he's hiding something, and there's a little bit of a mystery going on there.
Well, and some people were very upset with that comic just because of the reading of Adam Strange. And
I think it's great. It actually, what is his name? Mr. Terrific?
Right.
Yeah. Who I always thought was just a silly character. Made him like, oh, this is a great character. Anyway, I like Tom King's reading of things and taking old characters and subtly changing them and making them dynamic and rich. And this is definitely an example of that. Plus, the art's great. Just awesome.
Tom King does get good artists.
Yes, he does. I think he should stick to the 12-issue limited series. When he starts going into longer runs, it sort of peters out after a while. I don't know if you agree with that or not.
Batman.
Yes. Okay.
I mean, that seems to be kind of his bailiwick.
Yes.
As the kids say.
Yes, all the kids are running around saying bailiwick.
Bailiwick.
Tally-ho, what's your bailiwick? That's what, that's what the kids are saying these days on the
Twitter. That is.
Yeah, on the TikTok.
I'm the Tic Tacs.
Exactly. What's your number four, Brian?
I just like creating this persona of like the old man who doesn't know anything, which may or may not be the persona. So number four. It's funny you mentioned Tom King. At number four, I have, and Watchmen fans, Watchmen purists, you may want to go hide in the corner right now. I have Rorschach by Tom King and Jorge Fornes. Again, art. Woo! Also, it's not a Watchmen comic.
Well, no.
It is. If you've ever watched late 60s, early 70s spy thrillers, Day of the Condor, movies like that, which are all fantastic. That's mm-hmm. what this is. This is Tom King doing that.
Yes, it's a character study, which is what Tom King does. He takes a character study and studies it.
That doesn't feature any of the Watchmen characters. It features the Rorschach as an idea. And I think that's the brilliance of it is, everybody wrote it off. There's cranky, fussy pants out there who probably didn't even give it the time of the day. Probably didn't watch the great HBO series either because they were going to stomp their feet and turn Dr. Manhattan blue, with their purity rings and whatnot. And what they missed out on is a stinking fantastic government conspiracy espionage thriller with a little PTSD that also features Frank Miller as a character in a way that Frank Miller haters would probably appreciate. It's an incredibly well done comic. It's a comic that, like I said, I think people have not allowed themselves to enjoy or even try because they decided that it was something that it most certainly is not. And it's the best. It's the second best crime comic that I've read this year.
Oh, a little bit of a tease?
Maybe.
Okay. Well, yes, and I agree. That was actually on my honorable mentions list that I thought of. So yeah, I really like Tom King's when he's doing depression and PTSD. Boy, knocks it out of the park every time.
Yeah.
Okay. So my number four is actually one of your honorable mentions, Swamp Thing by Rom V and Mike Perkins. That has just been okay. First of all, people may know I have a penchant for swamp creatures.
Yes.
It's one of my favorite little subgenres. And
heard all about your man thing.
Yeah, that's right. Man things and cosmic rods. That's what I like. But anyway, Rom V has just taken Swamp Thing, which is a great character.
Yeah.
And reinvented Swamp Thing. And it's so interesting and dynamic and really taking the character to different places. And
lots of new ideas.
Exactly. Rom V, man.
Can't say enough about Mike Perkins' art.
Yes, absolutely.
Mike Perkins should be chained to a desk and never be allowed to do anything but Swamp Thing for the rest of his life.
Absolutely. Yes, that's what we are. That's what we're advocating for. Yes.
Yeah, since I'm certain he's listening to this, I don't really mean that, sir.
Okay, your number three.
Number three. Okay, bear with me, people. There's even a joke in the latest issue about what I'm about to probably do. My number three is The Good Asian, written by, deep breath, Porn Sack Picachote.
I think that's good.
Well done, sir. By Alexandre Tefengi. The latest issue does talk about how certain folks cannot pronounce. It makes a joke about people not being able to pronounce Asian folks' names, and so I believe I have just committed that sin in some way. But I apologize. He does have the greatest first name in all of comics, Porn Sack. But no, The Good Asian, which is my number one crime comic of the year. Good Asian is it's Ed Brubaker good.
Yes, I have actually just begun that. So I started it about a week ago. So I'm up to issue three. It's been great.
Yeah, but just very noirish, But yeah, it's I just think it's this comic gets better and better as the mystery deepens. It's a 12 issue limited series. We're on issue 8 or 9, but this has been a treat every time a new issue comes out. So that's my three.
Okay, my three is The Nice House on the Lake by James Tinian IV and Alvar Martinez. It is a Black Label, DC Black Label. I just want to point out that the last three comics are all DC. Who knew that that was going to be the case?
Well done.
Yes, I know. But this is a kind of horror comic. It's a group of people who have been gathered in a nice house on the lake while the apocalypse happens. So they're nice and safe and sound in this nice house on the lake while the entire world has collapsed. As it progresses, you start to see more. It's kind of like Big Brother, like the show Big Brother, mm-hmm. except end of the world. Picture Big Brother with the end of the world happening outside.
I kind of feel like the few times I've seen episodes of Big Brother, it is sort of like the end of the world.
Yes, yes. But anyway, it's James Tinian, and he does just that creepiness, you know, because a mystery evolves as the series goes on. But it's really been engaging and just good stuff.
All right. Number two, I have a suspicion.
I think our number one and two are probably the same.
I have a feeling our number one and number two might be the same. So I will tell my number two, and then you can tell your number two. And if they match up, we can discuss it as a whole, as opposed to individually. Number two, Department of Truth, James Tinian and Martin Simmons.
Shockingly enough, that is not my number two as well. Goodness gracious. This has just been an absolutely stunning comic.
It's like it's conspiracy theory done right.
Exactly. It's what the X-Files wanted to be.
And were at a point.
Okay, it's what the X-Files revival wanted to be.
Yeah, well, there's that.
Yeah, I mean, and, you know, and the art is so disturbing, that scratchy kind of...
Yeah, Martin Simmons is doing killer work on him.
Yeah, but for anyone who doesn't know, it's Department of Truth is when enough people believe in a conspiracy, it actually becomes reality. So the Department of Truth has to get people to believe otherwise. It's, and I'm not doing it justice, it's really fascinating.
Yeah, well, or they need to get them to believe it more strongly, depending on the conspiracy, depending on the mythology. But yeah, it is not something I expected from James Tinian at all. I think overall, he's a fine writer. I know people are really invested in some of his works. I have not loved his Batman run as much as others have.
You got to put Batman beside, you know, to the side.
Well, yeah, because he's writing for, yeah. But like some of his other work, I'm like, it's okay. I was not expecting this to be as amazing as it is.
See, I would disagree, because I'm one of those people who really likes James Tinian's work, obviously, from my last pick was also James Tinian. So I really, really like his independent work outside of the mainstream DC Marvel. I mean, he did Black Label, of course, but that's a little bit different.
Right.
Yeah, so the stuff he's doing for Boom and Image, it's great.
But Department of Truth is just, it's very wordy.
There's nothing wrong with that, yeah.
Which I no no I you'll see from number one and you know others that I don't mind wordy,
yeah.
But no, it's just a really it's such a creative piece of work because it takes a kind of a generic idea and just twists it all around.
Right, and it makes it kind of touching and personal. And when I talk about wordy, there's one issue that's all about Bigfoot, which is told in letters.
Right,
and typically, whenever someone's writing, you know, a comic book writes in script, drives me crazy.
There's only certain authors who could get away with that. Neil Gaiman. Neil Gaiman.
Yeah, there's not Neil Gaiman, too. but it's so, because it's told from one person's perspective, you know, writing these letters. And it's, you know, it's a story about Bigfoot, but it becomes this tender, heartbreaking story. And it's just incredibly well done. So Department of Truth. I can pretty much guess what your number one is because it's mine.
I can guess what your number one is. We telegraphed this, I think, a few episodes ago.
Yes, we did.
It's The Many Deaths of Layla Starr, Starr, Ron V and Philippe Andrade. We gave this away a while back, but time has not changed my opinion. And if we were doing a top 5 or 10 of the decade, that this would be hard pressed to be supplanted.
Not only is this my favorite comic of the year, it is far and away beyond anything else. There's my list, and then like way over there is Many Deaths of Layla Starr, because this, it's so good. If you haven't listened to our episode of I think it's two back, I think we praised it pretty strongly, but it's best of the decade stuff. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's so good.
I mean, it's evergreen stuff.
Yes.
I mean, this is, I know the people would buck at me, you know, putting it up against, Time Has to Tell, in some ways. And, you know, like something like Sandman is ran for many, many issues and over time and has, infiltrated. I don't think this will infiltrate, culture in the same way that, say, a Watchmen or a Sandman will, just because it's not trying to. It's big ideas writ small as opposed to big ideas writ large.
Well, I think this is going to be influential for a long time to come.
I absolutely agree with it being influential. It's just tremendous storytelling. Again, we're probably repeating some of the stuff we did a couple weeks ago, but time will tell, but I haven't run across anything that I feel challenges it at this point.
No, me as well. It is, like I said, far and away my favorite comic of the year. It's one that I still think about. I read this and was blown away, and then you recommended it for the show. And I remember when you recommended it, you said, we talked before the show, and you said, it just came out recently. Do you think it's okay to talk about? I was like, oh, yeah. I wanted to talk about this comic. So I think it's, like I said, this is going to be one of those comics that is fondly remembered and influential for years and years to come.
Absolutely.
Yeah. All right. So that's our list, everyone. If you have favorite comics of the years or you disagree with our list, let us know in the comments or send us an email. Hit us up on Twitter, because, God knows, someone should start putting their opinions on Twitter, because no one's doing it.
The kids are all twitting and...
Yes. But anyway, let's take a break. And when we come back, we'll talk about Cosmic Rods.
Woohoo!
And we're back. Brian, how did you like your break?
It was fantastic.
Are you well rested?
I am well rested. No vomiting today.
Just so everybody knows, that little tiny break you just heard lasted us 7 days. Yes, we had a little issue in our recording session. Brian, I hope you're feeling better.
I am feeling better.
So let's get to this, shall we? So, Brian, this week... It's your pick. Why don't you tell us all about it?
Okay, I shall. Nostalgia is a funny thing. It has the power to instill positive feelings, to bring comfort and peace in times of uncertainty, or when a person is feeling as if the world they know is beyond their control and their place in it is becoming diminished. The song that was playing when we had our first kiss is one of the greatest songs ever written, it is known. Watching Star Wars at the age of 5 with your dad at a drive-in theater. Man, all movies made now suck in comparison. Clothing, toys, social activities, cars, everything was better back in the day. Of course, none of this is true. Memory is selective and is often a liar. The bad things, the unjust things, the negative things are all swept under a fuzzy haze of false perception. We collect nostalgia, put it in safe corners, a cocoon to protect us. As Milan Kundera wrote,
The struggle of man against power is the struggle of memory against forgetting. James Robinson's much-beloved run on Starman is steeped in nostalgia. Its titular hero, Jack Knight, is a modern Sisyphus, pushing ever-uphill against the modern. He is, as his father refers to him, a junk man who traffics in ye olden times. His shop is, humorously named, Knight's Past. Clever, that. Jack is all of us, the collectors, the board and baggers, the original packaging fanatics. He is our everyman. It is Jack's growth and his conflict that forms the crux of the series narrative. In today's reading, we are discussing the first arc of Jack Knight's journey, Sins of the Father, which collects issues 0 through 5 of what would become a stunning and seminal 8-issue run. With art by Tony Harris, Robinson introduces us to the fantastical Opal City and its hero, Starman. Starman is a complex character in the DC universe, the nomenclature used by a variety of individuals over the decades. But the focus here is on the Ted Knight iteration and his two sons, hence the title. Most of the issues are prelude, with hints and allegations of the long story Robinson had mapped out. But there is, of course, a concise tale. Robinson plays the origin of his new Starman relatively safe. A conflict, a self-discovery, a bad guy, good triumphs, etc., etc., etc. Yet complexity exists, a family dynamic that is fractured, a city that is a character unto itself, a villain who is not a villain. Supporting characters are introduced, characters who have history and will be important to Jack's journey, a phallic weapon, and lots of emo exposition. Lots of emo exposition. It is the 90s, after all. So, a hero's journey writ small, with cosmic implications. Paul, obviously I recommended this, as we often do in this podcast. I'm throwing it to you for your initial reactions. What did you think, Paul?
I'm of two minds on this. Well, first of all, let me say, this is a classic run of this comic, and it's very good. When I say I'm of two minds, it's because Jack Knight, I don't like him as a character.
Huh.
Yeah. Now, all right, now let me just say, I understand. I understand why he was written this way. And I do, and I have read this whole thing, not just this these 5 issues, but I've read the entire run.
Wow.
Yeah, I know.
Like, you read it. I mean, I've read the entire run, but you mean just...
No, not of Starman, but of... Yeah, I mean, of this particular iteration.
Okay.
So I know so what I'm saying is Jack Knight as a character, I know he grows and becomes more heroic. So I understand intellectually why he was written this way. But he starts out as just such an whiny, insufferable, entitled jackass. And it's just so hard to get behind this character. When you're reading him, there's so many pages where I just went, oh, shut up. Oh, for God's sakes, get over yourself. So Jack is a dick is what I'm saying. And
well, I did in my intro mention that there was some emo involved.
Oh, my God. Yes. Yeah. Like I said, so I'm of two minds. Like I don't like this character, but at the same time, I like the story. If that makes sense. Mm-hmm. And there are things that were done with Jack as a character that we'll talk about. I like how you slowly get his backstory and what it's like, what it was like for him growing up.
Right.
It's not until one of the final issues that I finally said, okay, I kind of like this guy. No, I never liked him. That's wrong. I can finally tolerate this guy. And boy, he really had to overcompensate with that staff.
Well, I mean, it's not comics if there's not like, well, I mean, what I love about James Robinson's writing in this, you know, there's a lot of, nudge and wink. And, you know, right. I mean, he even acknowledges with the staff he did, you know, as the... what is it, as the woman said to the bishop when he makes this staff feels really good in my hands.
Right. Yeah.
And everything, like art-wise, a lot of things in this comic, there's a lot of phallic imagery.
Oh, yes.
Ted Knight's original home base and then his new home base are both big penises.
Yes, yes. I see that, yes. By the way, Cosmic Rod was my stripper name back in the day.
But I find your take on Jack very interesting. We'll get into specifics. I kind of have the opposite reaction to Jack in some ways. I agree with you. He's, of course, you know, he is self-involved. He is, you know, in many ways what we would call collector scum, or, you know, he's a junk man. But I also, as a comic book fan and as a collector of various things, I understand Jack a little bit. I think it's very interesting how Robinson wrote him. I also think that he is treated like dog shit.
Is he?
By his dad and by the O'Dares initially and by his brother. And so part of me is, you know, who are the dicks in this? Well, it isn't, if Jack is a dick, I guess you might have to give like a caveat before we before this episode for language. But if Jack is a dick, everybody else around him are also kind of complete assholes.
That is true.
You know, so it's his motivation, you know, I think is trickier than him just being a petulant child. His dad is brutal, absolutely brutal. And I think in many ways it's unwarranted. You know, the only person, there are only like two characters that treat him with any sort of respect in any way, shape, or form, and that's the Shade and then Charity. And we'll get to those two in a bit. But they're the only two people who give him any benefit of the doubt.
Yeah, well, no, you get sort of things. Like the dad is awful. Ted Knight, of course, you know, Ted Knight. And, this is before
Ted Knight that we know from the...
Yeah, I was going to say before, you know, this is after he's gone on to fame as a newscaster.
Right.
Working for Lou Grant. Yeah, but at the same time, he keeps doing these lines like, I always knew you'd be a hero. It's like, really? Did you? Because there's absolutely nothing in Jack, in any of the backstory, that says, yeah, this kid's destined for something.
He's why should he be?
Well, okay, that's fine. Then make that the story. Not everyone sees something in him that he doesn't see it himself. I didn't see it.
Well, that's not, Hero's Journey 101.
But there's usually a spark of something. You usually get like a glimpse of him being heroic in some way, but it's not.
But he doesn't want to be that guy, except of course we find out later that maybe he did want to be that guy, but memory, as I mentioned earlier, is selective.
Right.
And you know, it's legacy is complicated. And you know, when you grow up the son of nobody here listening to this has grown up the son of a superhero. Now, some of us have grown up, you know, the children of firefighters or, you know, various other people who perform heroic deeds.
Yeah, my dad was a cop.
Right. In real life, people performing heroic deeds. But, you know, I was the son of a preacher man, literally, twice. And, you know, to be honest, there were expectations growing up that, you know, I would also continue on that path.
It was your cross to bear.
It was my cross to bear. And, you know, boy, howdy, let me tell you, that was not a legacy that I was or continue to be interested in any way, shape, or form. But that was an expectation put on me as a child and as a young man, and even going into college, and it was assumed that I was going to follow in this particular path, and I sure as heck did not. So, you know, I think what Robinson does with Jack is sort of that same thing. You know, it's his father. We get these flashbacks, and some of the flashbacks are very fascinating because, again, they're about selective memory, and in some cases they are reversed as Jack remembers things the way they were and then suddenly remembers things differently within this. Mm-hmm. But I think, you know, he as a character, he was following his own path and was kind of treated poorly by both his brother and his father going forward in that he didn't follow the path that they had decided he was going to follow. We all have to find our way.
But even
I don't mean this is an Oprah session where we're going to talk about our feelings, but I think that the reading of Jack as just a selfish, you know, emo kid is maybe a little bit unfair. And I think Robinson plants some ideas that maybe that is unfair to Jack. His father calls him a coward. I mean, I have notes here of all of the really shitty things that Ted Knight says to him.
But did you take all the notes of the shitty things that Jack says? I mean, even in his, you know, collecting all his memorabilia and stuff, he is just the worst hipster cliche. Like there's things where he's trying to pick up, oh, I can get that album anywhere. What I need is, you know, all the stuff that I know is cool and you don't. It's like, God, just, oh, you're awful.
He's running a business and his business is to sell things. And
but you don't have to be so arrogant about it.
Right. But they talk about the Pezzes at some point, like Pezzes. And he's like, he says, you know, I don't want Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle Pezzes. I want X, Y, or Z Pezzes. Well, that's his business. And he's not going to sell Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle Pez.
But he's such a neckbeard about it, dude. There's a way to say.
There's part of me that respects that. It's
Doctor, oh wow.
But this is his passion, right? This is what he is passionate about. And yes, it's such a product of the 90s in some ways, because this is everybody we hated, and partly because what we hated about him is what we saw in ourselves. And because I am horrendously pretentious about literature sometimes. And is that fair?
So we're not going to have a conversation about Daniel Steele at any point in time.
No.
The new Nicholas Sparks novel just came out.
Right. If I'm a bookseller and I want to sell good books and I want to sell books that are valuable, am I going to sell a first edition James Joyce, or am I going to sell a mass market paperback of Daniel Steele? So the James Joyce, I'm going to get thousands and thousands of dollars for. The Daniel Steele, maybe I get a quarter for.
But you'll sell a hell of a lot more of the Daniel Steele.
Sure.
So that's consistent income.
How many 25-cent Daniel Steeles do I have to sell to equal that $2,000? Actually, it'd be a lot more. I'm using James
that's,
Joyce.
That's kind of a balance in business. And let's not, I think we're getting far afield here.
Right.
The idea is, so you're seeing something in Jack Knight that I'm not, I guess, is a way to put it. Right. No.
I don't agree. I don't disagree with you that he is made out to be selfish and self-involved in some ways, but I don't think he's any more selfish or self-involved than his father is, than his brother is, than the O'Dares with their legacy. And I think he gets scolded constantly by people who have the same hangups he does. They're just different hangups, and they want Jack to have the same hangups they do.
Fair enough.
And we haven't even talked about the story yet.
Yeah. And I do want to reiterate, I understand why Jack was written this way, because mm-hmm. you start at the bottom and you build up to something greater.
Right. There's no character development if the character starts at the end point.
Yes. Yes. I just want to point out that I do understand what a story arc is. So, you know, but I also understand. Yeah, that was fun. That was not unexpected. Well, continue. Let's hear about the story, Brian.
But to the story, the story is intriguing, and it's slightly basic. So it's basic and complex at the same time.
I think the story itself, like you said, is basic, but the way the characters interact with that story is where the complexity comes in.
Right. I mean, we start off with, it's actually the very first, I love the fact that the very first line of the first issue, issue zero, because
the 90s had to have zeros.
But the first line in the story is, there is a city. And I love that. Love that as a first line, because as we'll talk about, the city is as much a character as any human person. That first 5 or 6 pages are brutal, absolutely brutal. So what happens is we have David Knight, the son of Ted Knight and the brother of Jack Knight, who has taken on the mantle of Starman. And as I mentioned in my intro, Starman is a very complex character within the DC universe. Nobody really wants us to go into a deep dive of the history of Starman. Probably most of the listeners already know this.
See, that's the thing. I don't. I mean, I understand the overall idea of Starman, but there's so much going on with that character that I don't think I truly understand what the history is. I know what I know.
Right.
Yeah.
But you don't have to know all of that, because you've read the whole series at this point, so you know James Robinson fills us in.
Right. Yeah, I've read the Robinson series, I'll say.
Yeah.
That. Yeah.
The beginning of this comic is this wonderful, and Tony Harris's art, fantastic. Mm-hmm. It's perfectly aligned to the story, and sort of there is a noirish element to this. Did I say Tony Robbins? Tony Harris.
Heavens. Tony Robbins. Well, he, you know.
That's another.
Yeah, this gives you a lot of motivation to
Tony
do.
Tony Robbins could have really helped Jack Knight out with motivation.
Exactly.
Tony Harris's art is phenomenal. But so the story starts off, and it's this wonderful cityscape of Opal City. And, you know, you have David Knight dressed in the traditional kind of golden age Starman costume with the fin and all of that. And he's standing high up in the city, like on a windowsill overlooking the city. And there's a lot of dialogue, internal dialogue about how he is taking over the mantle and he's really proud of being a superhero. And, you know, all of this history, all of these things kind of mashing together. And he prepares to jump off the windowsill to go fight crime and gets shot through the heart.
Which is an excellent way to start, because your expectations are to follow this character throughout the comic run. And then suddenly, oh, well, that happened.
You know, I mean, the art, it's the way that Harris just shows this, you know, you see the bullet come through him. Nobody can see my hand movements here, but you see the bullet come through him and then he just falls.
Right.
And you watch him fall over several panels and then just boom, like on the pavement. Wow. I mean, that's a hell of a start to a comic.
Yeah, absolutely. If you're going into this not knowing anything about the character, it is shocking. It subverts your expectations, as the kids say.
It's a serious what the?
Yeah.
So what ensues, of course, is so we find out that that David Knight was killed by the son of the Mist, and the Mist is one of the original, or I hate to say the word original Starman, but for this story, the Ted Knight Starman, the dad, one of his original foes. Mm-hmm. And what follows, of course, is we find out that the Mist is attempting to take revenge on Ted Knight for reasons that all supervillains do. They're mad, they're its legacy, its whatever else. So the Mist has sent his son Kyle and his daughter Nash out to mess with Ted Knight and his legacy. And what that involves is, well, first they kill David, then they attack Jack Knight in his store, they blow up Ted Knight's laboratory, and they proceed to try to destroy everything about Ted Knight's life and his legacy. And all of this is because the Mist wants some sort of revenge. Through all this, Jack, who wants nothing to do with this legacy, is put in various situations where he has to start doing superheroing very reluctantly.
Yeah, he's forced into a position where he has to defend his father, or he has to step up, basically.
At some point, he has to attempt to try to defend his mother's legacy, because the Mist is looking. What the Mist wants to do is destroy everything that Ted Knight loves, which means his sons, his legacy, and his dead wife's legacy. And he wants to leave Ted Knight bereft and mourning.
Wants to make him suffer.
Right. So, plot-wise, what we have is the Mist and his children battling against Jack Knight, the reluctant hero, and then Jack becomes a hero, and then he defeats the bad guys.
That's a very interesting way of putting it.
Right?
He becomes a hero and defeats the bad guys.
That's essentially the plot is, bad things happen, a hero is born and rises to the occasion reluctantly and defeats the bad guys with a lot of help. There's a lot of nuances here, but we'll get to those. But plot-wise, reluctant hero born, reluctant hero beats bad guys.
Yeah, well, there's
on into the rest of the story in future issues.
Yeah, well, there's a plot. Yeah, there's an element of Jack having to grow up, and you know, he's sort of in his, even though he's, how old is Jack? He's in his 20s.
Yeah, it's never explicitly, but he seems like mid to upper 20s, is my
right.
Guess.
You know, but he's still very boyish and very, you know, yeah, that emo teenager basically, and he has to actually step up and grow up.
Right.
There's that underlying idea.
Yeah.
And get beyond. He has to get beyond his, you know, let's face it, his abuse of his father and the rivalry with his brother.
His brother is very emotionally abusive.
Yeah. No. I'm, you know, don't get me wrong. Ted Knight's not a good guy either.
I feel like I need to reiterate that in case you cut out the earlier bit. I really need to, like, stress how emotionally abusive his father is to him. So he has to grow beyond that as well.
Well, it gets to, you know, there's an old cliched saying that, you know, if you knock me down, that's your fault. If you come back a week later and I'm still on the ground, that's my fault. And Jack has to get up.
But Jack didn't stay on the ground.
Did he? See, that's the thing. I think he kind of retreated into his own little shell of hipster pretension. And he needs to come out of that.
Right. And yeah. I get that we're doing a modern reading of this a little bit, but I also, like, I still feel like we need to, like, contextualize when this was written, but also remove it from time and allow it to be, like, a universal as opposed to, is Jack a hipster? Yes, but...
I'm using the term hipster, but that's been going on for a long time. I mean, there were we didn't call them hipsters in the 70s, but they were still there.
They existed. It's a type of person, and we get that. We keep coming back to this, which is
Jack's personality is the driving force of this story,
right? And it has to be, because he is the at the end of the day, he is Starman. He's not Starman at the beginning of this, but by the end of this story arc, he is Starman with reservation. And I think some of his reservations are legit. Like at the end of this, when he finally has a conversation with his father and he calls his father out and says, if I am going to do this, then you need to put your science to work helping other people as opposed to just being, you know, making it for superheroism. Great moment where he tells his dad, I will do this thing, but you have to change the way you use your technology and science. And his father agrees. But Jack also says at the end, I'm not going to be the policeman of Opal City. That's what the police are for. Right. And, you know, he says, I will do this thing that you want me to do, but I'm going to do it when it's necessary and not just, he's like, I'm not going out on patrol. He's like, that's what the police do. And that's a really great moment mm-hmm. because what he does is he reclaims, I think, a little bit of his independence while also calling out his father and saying, hey, you've kind of screwed up in the past. You could have used a lot of this stuff to help other people and you didn't. And he's like, I think that's it's a great moment where we see, you know, the unlikableness of Jack kind of diminishing while he agrees to do a thing, but also says there are caveats.
Right. He kind of he comes to grips with himself. You know, of who he is and comes to grips with his staff. Yeah, no, that is a great moment. And there's also a moment at the end, again, we're jumping forward here, but there's a moment at the end where he has a conversation with the spirit of his brother. And right. That's a real growth moment as well. He gets to understand his own motivations more.
Right.
But what you were saying about, you know, that is a fantastic, especially for the 90s, for Jack to call out his father about, you know, using your technology to help yourself when you could have been helping other people. But that's something that people always criticize Batman, the character of Batman, for. Bruce Wayne has all this money and he could be helping billions of people with that money, but he builds, you know, bat shark repellent and that sort of thing.
But it's also telling because, and this is one of the major themes that we could talk about in this. And one of the things is, as much as we say Jack is self-involved and Jack is this and the other, that part that we just mentioned calls back to, and here's where I think the real star of the series is, which is the city. As much as we want to call Jack out on being self-involved and, you know, all this emo stuff, he cared deeply about his neighborhood and his city and the people in his immediate environs mm-hmm. from the get-go. Like, you saw him, like, the series starts off showing Jack going from shop to shop, right? And there are many instances in this short six-issue run that shows him active in his community. So he's not self-involved just to be self-involved, because he already shows that he cares about his community and about the world around him. It's just not in the way that his father wanted.
Yeah, no, I get that. He grows and becomes a little bit, he becomes a better person throughout this series.
But he might have been a good person from the get-go.
Maybe. His dialogue and the way he's portrayed, I find him just kind of.
But I think Robinson had a lot, what's great about this is Robinson has a long game. Robinson is not playing the short game on this, and we see this throughout, and this is one of the great things that Robinson does with this. Half of this arc is foreshadowing, right?
Absolutely.
Everything is setting everything up. And I think that's really interesting. It's really interesting that how Robinson did this. I mean, you couldn't do this now, right? Because you wouldn't have an allowance of this idea that a comic book company would stick with you for 20 issues while you establish this long game.
Exactly. You know, and you see today there are writers like in our previous segment, we talked about Tom King, how right. he's really good when he does 12 issue series because he has a beginning and an end in mind. But that's right. pretty much what you get these days. You get 12 issues, maybe. It's not like the old days where you said, okay, you're going to have 100 issues to tell a story.
Right.
That you can build up over years and years. You wouldn't see a Phoenix saga happening today. But yeah, I mean, I like the way Robinson does that, where he is foreshadowing quite a bit. But he also, the way he tells backstory, I love the fact that it's usually when Jack's fighting.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. It's usually because he's not in the moment. He's like, he's fighting, but he's like, oh, you remember that time when I was a kid? And I love the fact that while this massive battle's going on, he's just remembering a conversation he had with his brother one time. It's a really great way to, it's a great way to get all that backstory while at the same time, what you're looking at are two people fighting.
Yeah. But what is interesting is that the backstory then plays into how he reacts within the action sequences that he's in.
Exactly. Yeah. No, it's very well done.
You don't see that. It's one of the spoiler alert. One of the biggest moments of you know, that sort of device that Robinson and Harris are using is when he is fighting the Mist's son, Kyle. We don't know this lad. Kyle, the Mist's son.
Yeah, Kyle Mist. So
they're fighting in the sky and, you know, it's a big action sequence and there's a lot of things going on and whatever. Like you said, there's these flashbacks that Jack is having during this battle. And while he's fighting for his life and for his father's life and, you know, the well-being of Opal City, you know, it's these flashbacks where you see his brother both being abusive to him and also being a good brother, which is what brothers do, right?
Yeah.
You know, and at one point, like, he's having these flashbacks of, like, both good and bad memories of his brother. And so we come back to present and, you know, Kyle, I'm going to call him Kyle Mist. It's like something like you hated you didn't even like your brother. You didn't, whatever. He brought up his brother and it brings Jack back into the present. He's like, no, I didn't like my brother, but I loved him. And then he kills him.
Yeah.
And
kills Kyle, we should say. Kills Kyle.
He kills Kyle Mist. You know, this passion arises in him and he gets it. The flashback adds to his angst during this battle and he acts out and actually kills somebody, followed by a lot of emo discussion on how sad he is about killing somebody and that he's never going to do it again, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Right. Well, this is, and again, very, very 90s, where you have to have some, a little bit of grimdark has to be thrown in. Just sprinkled right. a little bit. This is not as grimdark as many other things in the 90s, but.
Yeah, this isn't a grimdark. Now, there is grimdark that exists in all comics. You know, it's the mix of, you know, not everything can be shiny, happy people, and not everything should be. You know, I think this comic does a really good job of balancing the two.
Yeah, there's some nuance in this.
Well, I think this is a good point where we could say and transition.
Okay. Well, let's talk a little bit about the character of Opal City real quick.
Yeah, no, and I think that's like in my notes, I have several like points, you know, which is where we all are, you know, and it's nostalgia, cities, family, foreshadowing, Opal as character. And yeah, I mean, it's, I think one of the biggest aspects of this comic and one that we see going forward throughout the series is Opal City as a character in and of itself. There are great characters in this. I think Shade is one of the great characters mm-hmm. as well. But Opal City is beautifully rendered by Harris.
Yes, that just he uses what is that? It's Art Deco style of architecture, right. And it's gorgeous. All those straight, intricate lines and Oh, it's really good stuff.
It's interesting. I tend to recommend comics that have cities as part of the character. I mean, Astro City, Terminals.
Yeah.
I love when comics use the city as a character. And I think certain publishers do it better than others.
Well, you're going to talk about DC's cities. Real quick, let me give you a brief overview of the Marvel cities. New York. Okay, continue.
Exactly. it's my running joke. But I think it's one of the things I love about comics is when the environs are as important as the characters. And what Robinson does with Opal City is phenomenal from his writing standpoint. And then what Harris does visually is phenomenal too. Opal City is a strong character. And in these issues, we really get a sense of what's called the alleys, right? Which is the, it's sort of Robinson's initial introduction to the larger expanse of Opal City. Throughout, like in almost every issue there, the alleys, which is the where Jack has his store, but it's, you would call it the hipster neighborhood in some ways, but it is the oldest neighborhood. It's the neighborhood with all of the character and the oddities that happen. And he brings a lot of this into play in how Jack reacts to important things happen in the alleys. And it's all like cool shops and interesting individuals. And then he broadens it a little bit throughout this. We get a little bit more of the character of the city. But Robinson is creating a whole history.
And it plays into what you were saying in the introduction, which I didn't say this at the time, but your introduction was great. That was really well done. But, you know, when you look at a city in comics like this, I mean, Batman is Gotham. Superman is Metropolis. Now, Star City, I'm sorry, not Star City, Opal City. Let's try that again. Star Man, Opal City.
Star City is another great city, but anyway,
But Opal City has this veneer of nostalgia to it with that Art Deco style. And it's almost like it's a callback to a previous time. But by going into the underbelly, as it were, the alleys and so forth, you see the false veneer of that nostalgia that you were talking about in the opening. Opal City directly mirrors what Jack is going through, or what Jack is living in. I mean,
yes, he is the living kind of embodiment of the city. Starman is the heroic Starman is also the embodiment of the city. It's not one thing.
Yeah. Well, that you know what we saw in the beginning, where the old time costume with the face, then that's kind of the false front of what Starman. Right. You know, that's the nostalgia. That's the Art Deco style. And then you got Jack, who's just in his jeans and leather jacket with his goggles on, and that's the underbelly.
Well, there's a great scene where he's talking to, we haven't talked about the O'Dares yet, but the O'Dares are the police family that are intrinsically tied to the Starman legacy, which we find out way more history down the line. But, they talk about, they're the police, and they have always been the police of Opal City. They are linked so much into the lore of the city as well. But, I think you and I, and both independently of this, had spoken of this one particular passage that Robinson does that, again, Harris shows brilliantly. It's just all exposition by Robinson, but it talks about the city, and it's like several pages long.
Yeah, that's it's one issue that just it's almost like that issue is just about the city. You get a little bit into the characters too, but it just talks about over and over again how. The personality of the city, basically.
Right. Yeah. And every street, all the noises of the city creates a symphony. And the exposition is beautifully written because it's not just one song. It's a cacophony of songs that the music comes from the people and the noises of the city, and how he makes it into like a continual musical piece. This is great writing.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
And this is great. I'm having trouble fully. It creates and stretches and makes it an opera. It's almost an opera.
Yes, yes. If you ever heard right before an orchestra begins to play, where all the tuning up, and everyone's kind of getting their scales, and it's a cacophony of noise, and then suddenly it snaps, and
it resolves into
a beautiful melody, and yeah. That's exactly what this issue is. That's for me when the series starts to come alive. You know, the opening few issues are good. You get the story, you get to learn the characters, but then once you get the vibe of the city, the story just begins to click.
It's where the mythology starts to gel.
Right.
It starts to become, and this is why you see the Shade, who is one of my favorite characters in all of comics.
The Shade's great.
But it's where you see the Shade, who is a villain, or had been a villain. He was one of Ted Knight Starman's villains.
Yes.
And he's still a villain, except he's not, except he is. But you see where he talks about, like, the city is the most important thing to him. And his motivations, the issues that we're reading, are about preserving the city. It's not like he uses the knights as his avatars for the protection of the city. But at the end of the day, his primary concern is that the city that he has chosen remain peaceful and remain quiet. And it remains this place where he has retired from his villainy and can drink his absinthe or sherry and relax and enjoy the music of the city.
Yeah, the Shade's been around for a very long time.
And, he never dies.
He never dies. And, you know, the people come and go, but the city is eternal. That's his entire motivation. But because, you know, you have the Mist, whose motivations are, they're foggy. The Mist is a little foggy. he's putting on airs, as it were. But, but the Shade is so nuanced and complex.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I love this air of aristocratic, you know, almost royalty with the top hat and the, you know, Edwardian clothing. I wish we had spent more time with the Shade in the beginning.
Well, I mean, he's obviously like a major player, but he's also the history keeper. So one of the primary things running through the comic is his journal. And he's keeping the history of Opal City. And every great city, every great, you know, thing needs its storyteller. They need the keeper of the key.
And also, for narrative purposes, he's also the mystery keeper, because he's right. Just doling out little bits of information here and there, which propels Starman Jack to progress and move forward. While at the same time getting in his way from time to time. Yeah.
But his motivation is... I don't want to talk too much about future issues. Again, it's one of these creations. Well, it's not a unique creation. The Shade already exists. Robinson is creating some new characters, but he's also, a lot of these characters are characters that have existed that Robinson is reimagining.
Well, and an incredible, the Shade is far and away, like if you, in his original iterations in like The Flash, say, this is not that character. I mean, it's that character, but it's Robinson is adding so many facets to this character. It's almost like a new one. Yeah, right. Reimagining is an understatement.
But I think his character is so tied to for the purposes of this story arc, he is almost more tied to Opal City than he is to allegiance to the Knight family. Now that may or may not change later, but it's just so one of my notes is about foreshadowing, and I feel like I'm trying to move or keep concurrent.
It's so hard to just stay in what we've read. what our assignment is just this volume.
Yes. And so Opal City as an entity of itself bleeds into the Shade as a caretaker of the city, and then bleeds into the Shade as a caretaker of the Knights. So the Shade has some mysterious allegiances in this comic. At one point, he aligns with the Mist, but it turns out that he's aligning with the Mist for his own purposes that end up benefiting the Knights. All tied in. It's so fascinating.
Yeah, and it's also very symbolic that, you know, Opal City is this, in the light of day, looks like this shining, beautiful city. But in the dark places, say the Shade and the Night, that's where the real life happens.
Yeah, and we also get a lot of foreshadowing with there's numerous moments in this comic where we have these small little things that happen that have nothing to do with the comic that we're reading or the story arc that we're reading that will come back later. You know, there's a scene where Jack is fighting some of the bad guys, some of the Mist's bad guys. It's one of the fight scenes. In the shadows, we see, you know, somebody show up with a sword and take out a bunch of the bad guys. And we're like, wait, what is this? And Jack Knight is like, hey, what's going on over there? Well, whatever that isn't resolved in the story arc. And then in my favorite issue, which is issue 4, which could be issue 5 if we do away with the 0, there's a whole scene with a young woman going down into the subway and be sucked up into a painting. And then this mysterious person shows up, rolls up the painting, and wanders away. That's just random stuff introduced that isn't resolved in these 6 issues.
And I love that stuff. We used to get that a lot. Random things happening in comics that aren't paid off for, you know, 6 months to a year.
Well, and I think one of the best things, like, it's the foreshadowing in this comic. And there's a great scene, right, where Jack has had a big fight and he's running off back to the alleys to lick his wounds. And there's a store, like, he knows the alleys, right? That's that whole great area. Where he had his shop, and there's this whole, you know, there's a store that has suddenly appeared out of nowhere, and he's like, I know every inch of the alleys. I don't remember this store. So he goes into the store to kind of lick his wounds.
Oh yeah,
not lick his womb. lick his wounds, right? And he just needs a breather, so he walks into this store, and it's called like Forbidden. Or Fortunes and Forbidden Tales. And a couple issues earlier, he had seen it and was like, I don't remember this store. So he goes in and he meets this woman, Charity. And this is what's great about Robinson in his use of nostalgia. This woman, Charity, I had to look this up. This is not me like having encyclopedic knowledge. But Charity actually existed. So he walks into the store. It's a fortune teller. Her name is Charity. It turns out that Charity existed in a DC comic from the early 70s called Forbidden Tales of the Dark Mansion. It was, I think there was maybe 8 issues, 10 issues of this DC comic. But Charity was a character in that, where she was a fortune teller, she was the host. It was kind of an EC comic. She was the grave digger,
the crypt keeper, that sort of thing.
Crypt keeper, right? And so this is a callback to a briefly lived comic from the early 70s. She was the host, but also an active character within this. But it was all like Southern Gothic horror.
Awesome.
And so when we get to this comic, and Jack wanders into her store. You know, he's just trying to find a breather, but she's going to give him so much more, right? And so she talks about her past. Oh, I used to live in the South and now I'm here and I'm thinking about moving to something called Turk County, which again is foreshadowing. But she gives him his fortune, which lays out 40 issues of Starman.
Yeah, it's good. So you do know that there is a...
He's got a callback to a 70s comic at the same time while she's giving him foreshadowing, you know, 2 years later.
I didn't know that about that. I didn't know that about the old comic. That's great.
Well, I didn't either. I had to look it up.
Yeah. And this is actually the idea of, you know, a character wandering into a store or a cave, or, you know, this is an old mythological idea.
Right.
And then meeting a sage of some sort that will say, you know, this is what's going to happen. I'm setting you on your quest. Here's some cryptic information. Off you go. So, yeah. So it's, you know, Robinson is not only bringing this old character back, but he's also tying it into a very long mythological tradition.
Yeah. And then pushing it forward. It just... Yeah.
It's good stuff. I didn't know about that connection to the DC Comics from the 70s. So awesome.
But again, it's this whole, you know, I mean, a lot of this comic is a lot of these issues are foreshadowing. We have very real things that happen in real time, and we've touched on family dynamics. We've touched on the Knight family dynamics. We haven't touched on the O'Dares, and we don't necessarily need to. I mean, I think the O'Dares are a very interesting family that we're just getting generically introduced to, but they're referenced numerous times and they clearly have a history, and they're redheads, which I'm a big fan of.
I don't know. You can't trust them.
Nobody sees what we look like. I'm a redhead.
I'm a grayhead at this point.
well, as a redhead, I will eventually be a whitehead, because we don't go gray, we go white.
Now, but I think the O'Dares become more interesting down the line. In this one, they're just sort of, they're sort of there.
They're there. Yeah. I mean, we get some hints about, you know, there is talk about a Native American cop. There's, you know, Robinson's throwing out a little bit. But the hints, the things he's throwing out there are not, they don't affect the narrative of what's happening at the time that we're reading. You know, sometimes writers will give way too much, you know, sometimes when we read comics, it feels like the comic we're reading is all just like teasing us. And I think that exists a little bit more now than it used to, because writers are now writing to the 6-issue arc that can be collected in a collected edition.
Our bread and butter.
But, you know, it's sometimes like there's a lot of prologue without a lot of payoff. Mm-hmm. And the prologue is meant to keep you buying product. I think with James Robinson, what he's doing here, when he gives sort of these little hints of prologue, they're not about demanding you buy product going forward. They're serving the story that is existing at the time. Does that make sense?
Yes, absolutely it does. He's laying the groundwork for the story he wants to tell while still giving himself some wiggle room to, you know, to change things as the case may be. Because this isn't one, you know, he didn't write a huge a huge tome and then just dole it out month after month. This was an ongoing process.
Right.
But but it's always nice to know that a creator knows where they're going, but still allowing the story to evolve as it progresses.
So I guess we've kind of like touched most of the things at this point. So at the end of the day, though, we have to deal with the last 2 issues, both of which are kind of outside of the original narrative. We have our full story in issues 0 through 4 or 0 through 3. However that works, it's hard for me not to think of issue 0 as issue 1. But so final 2 issues in this arc are interesting. There is the final issue, which is just a bunch of talking. And the issue before it is a strange issue that allows for Jack Knight to finally meet the Shade, and they have a chat, and there's a lot of mythology kind of established between the two, and there's a relationship established between the two. It's my favorite issue in some ways, because it also involves a Hawaiian shirt.
That's right.
Right.
A deadly Hawaiian
shirt. And I love the fact that it's a frame. The Hawaiian shirt is a frame. It's about a Hawaiian shirt that is the gateway to heaven.
Which all Hawaiian shirts are, to be fair.
Well one could argue that.
I am currently wearing a Hawaiian shirt, by the way.
But it's a great kind of, it's the last two issues are one and dones.
But at the same time, they're setting the groundwork for what will come.
They're setting the groundwork for other things. So it's the next to the last issue that has the city as a symphony. And then it starts off with some rich guy who, well, it starts off with a mythology about a crazy person who lands in Hawaii in the early 1900s. And he's an artist and he starts making Hawaiian shirts. And then he makes a shirt that is the gateway to heaven. And then he disappears. It's just a random story, right? And that's what it starts with. And then we have a rich guy who wants this shirt, and he sends some guy to get the shirt. And then we get to the Opal City as a symphony portion, which is my favorite sort of four-page bit of the entire series, or the entire first part of the series. Then we get the Shade and Jack sitting down and talking about stuff. And very interesting things happen. And then we get Jack visited by the lackey of the rich guy who wants the Hawaiian shirt. And Jack's like, I don't care about the Hawaiian shirt. Just buy the Hawaiian shirt from me. And so the guy buys the Hawaiian shirt. He brings it back to his employer, the wealthy guy. And then the wealthy guy disappears. That's the comic.
Yeah. And I love the fact that you think this is going to be this big conflict over the shirt. And Jack just says, you know what? Here, just give me some money and you can have it. I really like that.
I'm not going to fight. Don't rob me. Yeah. Just pay me for the shirt. And the guy with the lackey with the gun trying to get the shirt is like, oh, sure. I'll pay you for the shirt.
Yeah. Yeah. Actually says, this is a store. Just buy it. Okay.
It's a fantastic moment where it deconstructs in some way superheroics, because the idea is that there didn't have to be a conflict.
Exactly.
Instead of a big fight, it was just like, oh, you just, you know, take the shirt, give me some money, and we're done.
Yeah. Just do a business transaction and we'll move on.
It's a really kind of fun idea.
Yeah. Yeah, I like it. And I do like that final issue. You said the final issue is just a bunch of talking. What it does for the comic moving forward, and it's the Jack visits a graveyard and sees the spirit of his dead brother.
Right.
And they have, they fight and they have a heart-to-heart and they come to a resolution of sorts. And I saw that. That's the most character growth for Jack in my mind. That's what I said, okay, this guy's not a complete dick. I can see what's going to happen with him. So that when you get, and it really does set the stage for who Jack is. These last two really do set the stage for what's going to happen with the rest of the series. I think it was really well done. And then it also has a little mystery where the brother, who I'm forgetting his name, the brother says, I'll see you again in a year.
Dave or David.
Yeah. So Dave says, I'll see you again in a year. You know, so that adds a little bit of mystery, a little intrigue of like, what, how is this happening? Why is this happening? Yeah.
And well, it sets the stage for future, you know, this becomes an ongoing thing. What I like about that issue is the use of black and white and color. To me, that final comic is more a Tony Harris. Well, not just Tony Harris, but the colorist, you know, it's gorgeously rendered.
Well, I should say that this whole comic is gorgeously rendered. There's a lot of intricacy, and you know, especially when you're in Jack's store, there's just so much little things, so many little details all over the place.
All the Easter eggs.
Oh yeah. Yeah, you can go through this whole thing. I remember
hate on Jack all you want, but his store rules.
Yes.
And it rules because he is the person that we choose to hate.
Sure. No, but there's so many things you can go back and catch. You know, there's some Ray Harryhausen creatures in there. And there's like little, there's so many little things kind of tucked away. A lot of little details.
So how much of that is Tony Harris's, artwork, and how much of that is James Robinson when he's writing the script? Is he saying include this, this, or the other? We don't know. That's the great part about a great artistic pairing that is mm-hmm. James Robinson and Tony Harris.
Yep. We've mentioned this many times on the show that when an artist and a writer are really in tune with each other, it just everything just clicks. You can't imagine it any other way.
I mean, to me, the last issue though is it's a lot of that to me is that's the emo part that I kind of was like, ugh,
really?
I'm gonna work my way through this.
Wow. See, we are getting so different. We have such different takes on this.
Which is what I love, right? Yeah. I mean, this is what's great.
Right. Yeah, no, it's just it's really amazing. How two people can read the same thing and get two different takes from it. It's almost like art is subjective.
And, what?
And people can get different things out of a piece of art. Neat.
Yeah. Yeah. But at the end of the day, I mean, I recommended this, and I recommended this because I still think this is one of the great, 80 issue. It's one of the comics that I go back to, and I think that these issues are they the sum of what goes forward? No. And the comic gets fantastically more complex and I think even better. But, there's a reason this series is beloved. And I also know why people are kind of like a little iffy about it. But right. At the end of the day, as a comics fan, this just... It just feeds everything I love about comics.
Right. And this was a period where there were long runs of not just reimagined comics, but just, so you had Sandman going on. You had Hellblazer, this Starman, Animal Man was happening.
Mm-hmm.
And you just had these really intricate, well-told stories. As much as we make fun of the extreme 90s, there was some great comics going on at this time.
Right. And I think DC was trying to, at that time, really kind of reinvent.
Yeah. And by the way, I didn't mean to do that, but I think I just mentioned all Vertigo titles. So there you go.
Well, but I think that some publishers were trying to go extreme with pouches and things like that.
I marvel at that sort of thing, but...
I think that DC of all places, like in the 90s, they did a lot of crap. Don't get me wrong. But I think there was an aspect of DC where they were trying to... This is an attempt to Golden Age stuff. And I get it. And James Robinson actually wrote a comic called The Golden Age. But I think that with titles like Starman... and some of the Vertigo titles and some other things that were happening then, I think there was an attempt to keep the integrity of the comics, the history of comics alive. And I'm not sure that every comics publisher was on board with that, but...
A lot of comic book companies were embarrassed by their... by the old comics and wanted to modernize it. Whereas you see comics like this, where they were embracing that, they weren't embarrassed by it. They were like, it's goofy and it's silly, but it's also fun and we can tell a good story around it.
And the same goes for like Sandman Mystery Theater, which was around the same time too.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, they were telling old school stories in an old school way.
With some modern twists to it, but
I think Starman still stands, and people can disagree. They could read the entire series and be like, it's corny, because there are absolutely aspects of this that are corny.
And I do think there's a lot of people who are like me who pick up this up and say, I don't like this character. He's an asshole. I'm not going to read anymore. Without knowing that it's done for a reason. His character is portrayed that way in order to change and grow. So I know it does turn people off. I wasn't a big fan of him in this particular arc, but I know that he gets better. But anyway, this, I agree with you. This is a classic comic.
It's fun. And yeah. At the end of the day, like when I think of like comics that just make me happy because they are comics.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's the Starman is one of the comics that I go back to a lot. I guess I call it a comfort comic.
Okay. Well, thank you for recommending this. It was good to go and read this again. I hadn't read this in years. So yeah, this is good stuff.
Okay. Well, right. I think we both semi-recommend this.
No, I definitely, I hope.
Enthusiastically recommend this.
I definitely wholeheartedly recommend this. Yes, I find the character of Jack Knight to be annoying, but that doesn't make the comic annoying.
No wrong.
It doesn't make the comic annoying. It makes it, you know, it's different. It, you know, anyway, it's a good comic. It's a classic. Read it.
Okay. Well, so that was Starman. I believe we will be taking a slight extended break.
Well, we will. By the time this comes out, there will be a new episode. Okay. Anyway.
This is our holiday. So this is our holiday post, which, you know, happy holidays, everybody. Woo-hoo. And when we hit the new year, Paul, I believe we will be talking about your recommendation. And I think you have a very intriguing recommendation.
Yes. So next time on an all new episode of the Collected Edition, for the new year, I decided to start with something, you know, a little light, a little uncomplicated, you know, to set the tone for the new year. And that is, we're going to be reading The Black Monday Murders by Jonathan Hickman and Tom Corker. This is a story about black magic and Satanism and capitalism, which all are, of course, the same thing.
So everybody, you know, bone up on your economic theory.
Yes. So this has been described as somewhat unapproachable for first-time readers of Hickman's work. So, you know, light reading.
Other parts of Hickman's work.
Hickman can get complicated, and boy howdy. So anyway, this will be interesting, I think, for us to dig into. But I like this comic, and I like Hickman.
And I think, Paul, you will need to, like, on our twits and whatever else, you'll need to, like, post a bunch of charts and graphs.
Oh, absolutely. Honestly, I love that Hickman does that. He has everything has a graph and a little Venn diagrams of where people fit. You got to love a story that has to be mapped out so that you can figure it out. Anywho, also in the new year, so we'll be, for our timeline, Brian, you and I, we'll be taking a few weeks off. By the time this comes out, this will come out the last week of December. So it'll only be a short gap. That is all to say, we'll be back on a regular release schedule of every 2 weeks, rather than how it's been going, which is huge gaps and then dumping a whole bunch of episodes all at once.
Groovy.
That's been my MO this year, and I'm really sorry about that. I had some weirdness happening. But also look for, yeah. Stuff happens. You know, the world's going to get better, isn't it? Please tell me.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, also look forward to a new website for the collectededitionpodcast.com.
Well, that's exciting.
Yeah. Well, it's a redesign, basically. And I'm going to be adding some new features like new articles and reviews and whatnot. Planning to launch that in January. So, yeah. So, stuff's going to get back to normal.
Folks should be aware that Paul is the one that does all the work here.
Well, when I do the work, I do the work. Yeah. But
Paul is the genius workhorse behind this. I just come in and ramble.
But people
should give Paul credit. And Paul, don't cut this. Don't cut this. Okay. Paul is the genius behind all this, and folks should know that.
Thank you, Brian. But,
don't cut it.
Okay. You do ramble really well. this is all to say that in 2022, everything's going to get back to normal, and we're going to be on a regular schedule with brand new stuff happening. I have plans. I got plans, Brian.
All right.
So as always, please Thank you for listening, and leave us your comments and let us know what you think. CollectedEditionPodcast.com, Twitter at CollectedEDPod, that's CollectedEDPOD. Yeah, let us know what's going on. I guess that's it. Anything else, Brian?
Nothing else.
Okay, Happy New Year, everybody, and keep reading comics.
And read Saga.
You've been listening to The Collected Edition, a comic book podcast. The Collected Edition is a Daddy Elk production. All materials used on the program are copyright their respective copyright holders, and no infringement is intended. If you'd like to give us your feedback, the show can be found online at our website, collectededitionpodcast.com, where comments can be left on individual episodes, or send us an email to comments@collectededitionpodcast.com. The Collected Edition, a comic book podcast, is for entertainment purposes only.
Are you not entertained? Are you not entertained?
James Robinson's much-beloved run on Starman is steeped in nostalgia. Its titular hero.
Titular? just trying to keep abreast of the situation there.
Hand cut. And let's try that again.